and to 100 other such places, where he discovers for the first time that his guild is hated and despised, even by those, indeed most of all by those, who make use of its services. Soon there is scrubbing and kitchen work. Brother Cook performs such cooking as might be interesting or pleasurable, and the apprentice is left to pare vegetables, serve the journeyman, and carry an endless succession of stacks of trays down the stairs to the oubliette. I did not know it at the time, but soon this apprentice life of mine, which had been growing harder for as long as I could remember, would reverse its course and become less drudging and more pleasant. In the year before he used to become a journeyman, a senior apprentice does little but supervise the work of his juniors. His food and even his dress improve. The younger journeymen begin to treat him almost as an equal, and he has, above all, the elevating burden of responsibility and the pleasure of issuing and enforcing orders. When his elevation comes, he is an adult. He does no work but that for which he has been trained, and he is free to leave the citadel when his duties are over, for which recreation he is supplied with liberal funds. Should he eventually rise to mastership, an honor that requires the affirmative votes of all the living masters, he will be able to pick and choose such assignments as may interest or amuse him, and direct the affairs of the guild itself. But you must understand that in the year I have been writing of, the year in which I saved the life of Vodalus, I was unconscious of all that. Winter, I was told, had ended the campaigning season in the north, and thus brought the autarch and his chief officers and advisers back to the seats of justice. "And so," as Rosh explained, "we have all these new clients, and more to come, dozens, maybe hundreds. We might have to reopen the fourth level." He waved a freckled hand to show that he at least was ready to do whatever might be necessary. "Is he here?" I asked. "The autarch. Here in the citadel? In the great keep?" "Of course not. If he ever came, you'd know it, wouldn't you? There'd be parades and inspections and all kinds of goings-on. There's a suite for him there, but the door hasn't been opened in 100 years. He'll be in the Hidden Palace, the House Absolute, north of the city someplace. Don't you know where?" Rosh grew defensive. "You can't say where it is, because there's nothing there except the House Absolute itself. It's where it is. To the north, on the other bank. Beyond the wall?" He smiled on my ignorance. "Far past it. Weeks if you walked. Naturally, the Autarch could get here by flyer in an instant if he wanted to. The flag tower? That's where the flyer would land." But our new clients did not come in flyers. The less important arrived in coffles of 10 to 20 men and women, chained one behind the other by the neck. They were guarded by DeMarkey, hard-bitten troopers in armor that looked as if it had been made for use and used. Each client carried a copper cylinder supposedly containing his or her papers, and thus his or her fate. All of them had broken the seals and read those papers, of course, and some had destroyed them or exchanged them for another's. Those who arrived without papers would be held until some further word concerning their disposition was received, probably for the remainder of their lives. Those who had exchanged papers with someone else had exchanged fates. They would be held or released, tortured or executed in another's stead. The more important arrived in armored carriages. The steel sides and barred windows of these vehicles were not intended to prevent escape, so much as to thwart rescue. And no sooner had the first of them thundered around the east side of the witch's tower and entered the old yard than the whole guild was filled with rumors of daring raids contemplated or attempted by Votalus. For all my fellow apprentices and most of the journeymen believed that many of these clients were his henchmen, confederates, and allies. I would not have released them for that reason. It would have brought disgrace on the guild, which for all my attachment to him and his movement I was unready to do, and would have been impossible anyway. But I hoped to provide those I considered my comrades in arms with such small comforts as lay within my power. Extra food, stolen from the trays of less deserving clients, and occasionally a bit of meat smuggled from the kitchen. One blustering day, I was given the opportunity to learn who they were. I was scrubbing the floor in Master Gerlo's study when he was called away on some errand, leaving his table stacked with newly arrived dossiers. I hurried over as soon as the door had clanged behind him, and was able to skim most of them before I heard his heavy tread on the stair again. Not one of the prisoners whose papers I had read had been an adherent of Votalus. There were merchants who had tried to make rich profits on supplies needed by the army, camp followers who had spied for the Askians, and a sprinkling of sordid civil criminals. Nothing else. When I carried my bucket out to empty in the stone sink in the old yard, I saw one of the armored carriages halted there with its long-maned team steaming and stamping, and the guards in their fur-trimmed helmets sheepishly accepting our smoking goblets of malt wine. I caught the name Votalus in the air, but at that moment it seemed I was the only one who heard it, and suddenly I felt Votalus had been only an eidolon created by my imagination from the fog, and only the man I had slain with his own axe, real. The dossiers I had fumbled through a moment before seemed blown like leaves against my face. It was in this instant of confusion that I realized for the first time that I am, in some degree, insane. It could be argued that it was the most harrowing of my life. I had lied often to Master Gerlos and Master Palaemon, to Master Malrubius while he still lived, to Draught because he was captain, to Rosh because he was older and stronger than I, and to Eta and the other smaller apprentices because I hoped to make them respect me. Now I could no longer be sure my own mind was not lying to me. All my falsehoods were recoiling on me, and I, who remembered everything, could not be certain those memories were more than my own dreams. I recalled the moonlit face of Votalus, but then I had wanted to see it. I recalled his voice as he spoke to me, but I had desired to hear it, and the woman's voice too. One freezing night, I crept back to the mausoleum and took out the chrysos again. The worn, serene, androgynous face on its obverse was not the face of Votalus. Chapter 4 Triskel. I had been poking a stick up a frozen drain as punishment for some petty infraction, and I found him where the keepers of the bear tower throw their refuse, the bodies of the torn animals killed in practice. Our guild buries its own dead beside the wall, and our clients in the lower reaches of the necropolis. But the keepers of the bear tower leave theirs to be taken away by others. He was the smallest of those dead. There are encounters that change nothing. Earth turns her aged face to the sun, and he beams upon her snows. They scintillate and coruscate until each little point of ice, hanging from the swelling sides of the towers, seems the claw of the conciliator, the most precious of gems. Then everyone, except the wisest, believes that the snow must melt and give way to a protracted summer beyond summer. Nothing of the sort occurs. The paradise endures for a watch or two. Then shadows, blue as watered milk, lengthen on the snow, which shifts and dances under the spur of an east wind. Night comes, and all is as it was. My finding Triskel was like that. I felt that it could have and should have changed everything, but it was only the episode of a few months, and when it was over and he was gone, it was only another winter passed, and the feast of Holy Catherine come again, and nothing had changed. I wish I could tell you how pitiful he looked when I touched him, and how cheerful. He lay on his side covered with blood. It was as hard as tar in the cold, and still bright red, because the cold had preserved it. I went over and put my hand on his head, I don't know why. He seemed as dead as the rest, but he opened one eye then and rolled it at me. And there was a confidence in it that the worst was over now. I have carried my part, it seemed to say, and borne up, and done all I could do. Now it is your turn to do your duty by me. If it had been summer, I think I would have let him die. As it was, I had not seen a living animal, not so much as a garbage-eating thylacodon in some time. I stroked him again and he licked my hand, and I could not turn away after that. I picked him up, surprised at how heavy he was, and looked about trying to decide what to do with him. He would be discovered in a dormitory before the candle had burned a finger's width, I knew. The citadel is immense and immensely complicated, with little visited rooms and passages in its towers, in the buildings that have been erected between the towers, and in the galleries delved under them. Yet I could not think of any such place that I could reach without being seen half a dozen times on the way. And in the end, I carried the poor brute into the quarters of our own guild. I then had to get him past the journeyman who stood guard at the head of the stair leading to the cell tiers. My first idea was to put him in the basket in which we took down the client's clean bedding. It was a laundry day, and it would have been easy enough to make one more trip than was actually required. The chance that the journeyman guard would notice anything amiss seemed remote, but it would have involved waiting more than a watch for the scrubbed linen to dry, and risking the questions of the brother on duty in the third tier, who would see me descending to the deserted fourth. Instead, I laid the dog in the examination room. He was too weak to move, and offered to take the guard's place at the head of the ramp. He was happy enough to seize the opportunity to relieve himself, and handed over his wide-bladed carnificial sword, which I, in theory, was not supposed to touch, and his Felogen cloak, which I was forbidden to wear, though I was already taller than most of the journeymen, so that from a distance it would appear that there had been no substitution. I put on the cloak, and as soon as he was gone, stood the sword in a corner and got my dog. All our guild cloaks are voluminous, and this one was more so than most, since the brother I had replaced was larger frame. Furthermore, the hue Felogen, which is darker than black, admirably erases all folds, bunchings, and gatherings so far as the eye is concerned, showing only a featureless dark. With the hood pulled up, I must have appeared to the journeymen at their tables in the tiers, if they looked toward the stair and saw me at all, as a brother, somewhat more portly than most descending to the lower levels. Even the men on duty in the third, where the clients who had lost all reason howled and shook their chains, could have seen nothing unusual in another journeyman going down to the fourth when there were rumors that it was to be refurbished, or in an apprentice running down shortly after the journeyman went up again. No doubt he had forgotten something there, and the apprentice had been sent to fetch it. It was not a prepossessing place. About half of the old light still burned. But mud had seeped into the corridors, until it lay to the thickness of one's hand. A duty table stood where it had been left, perhaps 200 years before. The wood had rotted, and the whole thing fell at a touch. Yet the water had never been high here, and the farther end of the corridor I chose was free even of the mud. I laid my dog on a client's bed and cleaned him as well as I could with sponges I had carried down from the examination room. Under the crusted blood, his fur was short, stiff, and tawny. His tail had been cut so short that what remained was wider than it was long. His ears had been cut almost completely away, leaving only stiff points, shorter than the first joint of my thumb. In his last fight, his chest had been laid open. I could see the wide muscles like drowsy constrictors of pale red. His right foreleg was gone, the upper half crushed to a pulp. I cut it away after I had sutured up his chest as well as I could, and it began to bleed again. I found the artery and tied it, then folded the skin under, as Master Palaemon had taught us, to make a neat stump. Triskel licked my hand from time to time as I worked, and when I had made the last stitch, began slowly licking that, as if he were a bear and could lick a new leg into shape. His jaws were as big as an Arctother's, and his canines as long as my index finger, but his gums were white. There was no more strength in those jaws now than in a skeleton's hands. His eyes were yellow and had a certain clean madness. That evening I traded tasks with the boy who was to bring the clients their meals. There were always extra trays because some clients would not eat, and now I carried two of these down to Triskel, wondering if he was still alive. He was. He had somehow climbed out of the bed where I had laid him, and crawled, he could not stand, to the edge of the mud, where a little water had gathered. That was where I found him. There was soup and dark bread and 2 carafes of water. He drank 1 bowl of soup, but when I tried to feed him the bread, I found he could not chew it enough to swallow. I soaked it in the other bowl of soup for him, then filled the bowl again and again with water until both carafes were empty. When I lay on my cot almost at the top of our tower, I thought that I could hear his labored breathing. Several times I sat up, listening. Each time the sound faded away, only to return when I had lain flat for a time. Perhaps it was only the beating of my heart. If I had found him 1 year, 2 years before, he would have been a divinity to me. I would have told Draught and the rest, and he would have been a divinity to us all. Now I knew him for the poor animal he was, and yet I could not let him die because it would have been a breaking of faith with something in myself. I had been a man, if I was truly a man, such a short time. I could not endure to think that I had become a man so different from the boy I had been. I could remember each moment of my past, every vagrant thought and sight, every dream. How could I destroy that past? I held up my hands and tried to look at them. I knew the veins stood out in their backs now. It is when those veins stand out that one is a man. In a dream, I walked through the fourth level again and found a huge friend there with dripping jaws. It spoke to me. Next morning, I served the clients again, and stole food to take down to the dog, though I hoped that he was dead. He was not. He lifted his muzzle and seemed to grin at me, with a mouth so wide it appeared his head might fall in two halves, though he did not try to stand. I fed him, and as I was about to leave, was struck by the misery of his condition. He was dependent on me. Me. He had been valued. Trainers had coached him as runners are coached for a race. He had walked in pride, his enormous chest as wide as a man's, set on two legs like pillars. Now he lived like a ghost. His very name had been washed away in his own blood. When I had time, I visited the Bear Tower and struck up such friendships as I could with the beast handlers there. They have their own guild, and though it is a lesser guild than ours, it has much strange lore. To a degree that astonished me, I found it to be the same lore, though I did not, of course, penetrate to their arcanum. In the elevation of their masters, the candidate stands under a metal grate trod by a bleeding bull. At some point in life, each brother takes a lioness or bear sow in marriage, after which he shuns human women. All of which is only to say that there exists between them and the animals they bring to the pits a bond, much like that between our clients and ourselves. Now I have traveled much farther from our tower, but I have found always that the pattern of our guild is repeated mindlessly, like the repetitions of Father Aenir's mirrors in the House Absolute, in the societies of every trade, so that they are all of them torturous, just as we. His quarry stands to the hunter as our clients to us. Those who buy to the tradesman, the enemies of the commonwealth to the soldier, the governed to the governors, men to women, all love that which they destroy. A week after I had carried him down, I found only Triskel's hobbling footprints in the mud. He was gone, but I set out after him, sure that one of the journeymen would have mentioned it to me if he had come up the ramp. Soon, the footprints led to a narrow door that opened on a welter of lightless corridors, of whose existence I had been utterly unaware. In the dark, I could no longer track him, but I pressed on nevertheless, thinking that he might catch my scent in the stale air and come to me. Soon I was lost, and went forward only because I did not know how to go back. I have no way of knowing how old those tunnels are. I suspect, though I can hardly say why, that they antedate the citadel above them, ancient though it is. It comes to us from the very end of the age when the urge to flight, the outward urge that sought new suns, not ours, remained, though the means to achieve that flight were sinking like dying fires. Remote as that time is, from which hardly one name is recalled, we still remember it. Before it, there must have been another time, a time of burrowing, of the creation of dark galleries that is now utterly forgotten. However that may be, I was frightened there. I ran, and sometimes ran into walls, until at last I saw a spot of pale daylight and clambered out through a hole hardly big enough for my head and shoulders. I found myself crawling onto the ice-covered pedestal of one of those old, faceted dials whose multitudinous faces give each a different time, no doubt because the frost of these latter ages entering the tunnel below had heaved its foundation. It had slipped sidewise until it stood at such an angle that it might have been one of its own gnomons, drawing the silent passage of the short winter day across the unmarked snow. The space about it had been a garden in summer, but not such a one as our necropolis, with half-wild trees and rolling meadowed lawns. Roses had blossomed here in craters, set upon a tessellated pavement. Statues of beasts stood with their backs to the four walls of the court, eyes turned to watch the canted dial. Hulking Barolambdas, Arctothers, the monarchs of bears, Glyptodons, Smilodons with fangs like glaives. All were dusted now with snow. I looked for Triskel's tracks, but he had not come here. The walls of the court held high, narrow windows. I could see no light through them and no motion. The spear towers of the citadel rose on every side, so that I knew I had not left it. Instead, I seemed to be somewhere near its heart, where I had never been. Shaking with cold, I crossed to the nearest door and pounded on it. I had the feeling that I might wander forever in the tunnels below without ever finding another way to the surface, and I was resolved to smash one of the windows, if need be, rather than return that way. There was no sound within, though I beat my fist against the door panels again and again. There is really no describing the sensation of being watched. I have heard it called a prickling at the back of the neck, and even a consciousness of eyes that seem to float in darkness. But it is neither, at least not for me. It is something akin to a sourceless embarrassment, coupled with the feeling that I must not turn around, because to turn will be to appear a fool, answering the promptings of baseless intuition. Eventually, of course, one does. I turned, with the vague impression that someone had followed me through the hole at the base of the dial. Instead, I saw a young woman, wrapped in furs, standing before a door at the opposite side of the court. I waved to her and began to walk toward her, hurriedly because I was so cold. She advanced toward me then, and we met on the farther side of the dial. She asked who I was and what I was doing there, and I told her as well as I could. The face, circled by her fur hood, was exquisitely molded, and the hood itself and her coat and fur-trimmed boots were soft-looking and rich, so that I was miserably conscious, as I spoke to her, of my own patched shirt and trousers and my muddy feet. Her name was Valeria. "We do not have your dog here," she said. "You may search if you do not believe me." "I never thought you did. I only want to go back where I belong, to the Matachin Tower, without having to go down there again." "You're very brave. I have seen that hole since I was a little girl, but I never dared go in." "I'd like to go in," I said. "I mean, inside there." She opened the door through which she had come and led me into a tapestried room where stiff ancient chairs seemed as fixed in their places as the statues in the frozen court. A diminutive fire smoked in a grate against one wall. We went to it, and she took off her coat while I spread my hands to the warmth. "Wasn't it cold in the tunnels?"
"Not as cold as outside. Besides, I was running and there was no wind."
"I see. How strange that they should come up in the atrium of time."
She looked younger than I, but there was an antique quality about her metal-trimmed dress and the shadow of her dark hair that made her seem older than Master Palaemon, a dweller in forgotten yesterdays. "Is that what you call it? The atrium of time? Because of the dials, I suppose."
"No, the dials were put there because we call it that. Do you like the dead languages? They have mottos." Lux Dei Vitae Viam Monstrat. That's the beam of the new sun lights the way of life. Felicibus brevis, miseris hora longa. Men wait long for happiness. Aspice ut aspiciar.
I had to tell her with some shame that I knew no tongue beyond the one we spoke, and little of that. Before I left, we talked a sentry's watch or more. Her family occupied these towers. They had waited at first to leave Earth with the autarch of their era. Then had waited because there was nothing left for them but waiting. They had given many castellans to the citadel, but the last had died generations ago. They were poor now, and their towers were in ruins. Valeria had never gone above the lower floors.
Some of the towers were built more strongly than others, I said.
The witch's keep is decayed inside, too.
Is there really such a place? My nurse told me of it when I was little, to frighten me. But I thought it was only a tale. There was supposed to be a tower of torment, too, where all who enter die in agony.
I told her that, at least, was a fable.
The great days of these towers are more fabulous to me, she said. No one of my blood carries a sword now against the enemies of the Commonwealth, or stands hostage for us at the Well of Orchids.
Perhaps one of your sisters will be summoned soon, I said, for I did not want, for some reason, to think of her going herself.
I am all the sisters we breed, she answered, and all the sons.
An old servant brought us tea and small hard cakes. Not real tea, but the mate of the north, which we sometimes give our clients because it is so cheap. Valeria smiled.
You see, you have found some comfort here. You are worried about your poor dog because he is lame. But he too may have found hospitality. You love him, so another may love him. You love him, so you may love another.
I agreed, but secretly thought that I would never have another dog, which has proved true. I did not see Tricycle again for almost a week. Then one day, as I was carrying a letter to the Barbican, he came bounding up to me. He had learned to run on his single front leg, like an acrobat who does handstands on a gilded ball. After that, I saw him once or twice a month for as long as the snow lasted. I never knew whom he had found, who was feeding him and caring for him, but I like to think it was someone who took him away with him in the spring, perhaps north to the cities of tents and the campaigns among the mountains. Chapter 5. The Picture Cleaner and Others. The Feast of Holy Catherine is the greatest of days for our guild, the festival by which we are recalled to our heritage, the time when journeymen become masters, if they ever do, and apprentices become journeymen. I will leave my description of the ceremonies of that day until I have occasion to tell of my own elevation. But in the year I am recounting, the year of the fight by the graveside, Drott and Roche were elevated, leaving me captain of apprentices. The full weight of that office did not impress itself on me until the ritual was nearly over. I was sitting in the ruined chapel enjoying the pageantry and only just conscious, in the same pleasant way I was anticipating the feast, that I would be senior to all the rest when the last of it was done. By slow degrees, however, a feeling of disquiet seized me. I was miserable before I knew I was no longer happy, and bowed with responsibility
when I did not yet fully understand I held it. I remembered how much difficulty Draught had encountered in keeping us in order. I would have to do it now without his strength, and with no one to be to me what Rosh had been to him, a lieutenant of his own age. When the final chant crashed to a close, and Master Gerlose and Master Palaemon, in their gold-traced masks, had slow-stepped through the door, and the old journeymen had hoisted Draught and Rosh, the new journeymen, on their shoulders, already fumbling in the saber-tashes at their belts for the fireworks they would set off outside, I had steeled myself and even formed a rudimentary plan. We apprentices were to serve the feast, and before we did so, were to doff the relatively new and clean clothes we had been given for the ceremony. After the last cracker had popped, and the matrosses, in their annual gesture of amity, had torn the sky with the largest piece of ordnance in the Great Keep, I hustled my charges, already, or so I thought, beginning to look at me resentfully, back to our dormitory, closed the door, and pushed a cot against it. Ita was the oldest, except for myself, and, fortunately for me, I had been friendly enough in the past that he suspected nothing until it was too late to make effective resistance. I got him by the throat and banged his head half a dozen times against the bulkhead, then kicked his feet from under him. "Now," I said, "are you going to be my second? Answer!" He could not speak, but he nodded. "Good. I'll get Timon. You take the next biggest." In the space of 100 breaths, and very quick breaths they were, the boys had been kicked into submission. It was 3 weeks before any of them dared to disobey me, and then there was no mass rebellion, only individual malingering. As captain of apprentices, I had new functions, as well as more freedom than I had ever enjoyed before. It was I who saw that the journeymen on duty got their meals hot, and who supervised the boys who toiled under the stacks of trays intended for our clients. In the kitchen I drove my charges to their tasks, and in the classroom I coached them in their studies. I was employed, to a much greater degree than previously, in carrying messages to distant parts of the citadel, and even in a small way, in conducting the guild's business. Thus I became acquainted with all the thoroughfares, and with many an unfrequented corner. Granaries with lofty bins and demonic cats, wind-swept ramparts overlooking gangrenous slums, and the Pinacothican, with their great hallway topped by a vaulted roof of window-pierced brick, floored with flagstones strewn with carpets, and bound by walls from which dark arches opened to strings of chambers lined, as the hallway itself was, with innumerable pictures. Many of these were so old and smoke-grimed that I could not discern their subjects, and there were others whose meaning I could not guess. A dancer whose wings seemed leeches, a silent-looking woman who gripped a double-bladed dagger and sat beneath a mortuary mask. After I had walked at least a league among these enigmatic paintings one day, I came upon an old man perched on a high ladder. I wanted to ask my way, but he seemed so absorbed in his work that I hesitated to disturb him. The picture he was cleaning showed an armored figure standing in a desolate landscape. It had no weapon, but held a staff bearing a strange, stiff banner. The visor of this figure's helmet was entirely of gold, without eye slits or ventilation. In its polished surface, the deathly desert could be seen in reflection, and nothing more. This warrior of a dead world affected me deeply, though I could not say why, or even just what emotion it was I felt. In some obscure way, I wanted to take down the picture and carry it, not into our necropolis,
but into one of those mountain forests of which our necropolis was. As I understood even then, an idealized but vitiated image. It should have stood among trees, the edge of its frame resting on young grass. "And so," a voice behind me said, "they all escaped. Vodalus had what he had come for, you see." "You," snapped the other. "What are you doing here?"
I turned and saw two armigers dressed in bright clothes that came as near to exultance as they dared have them. I said, "I have a communication for the archivist," and held up the envelope.
"Very well," said the armiger who had spoken to me. "Do you know the location of the archives?"
I was about to ask, sir.
"Then you are not the proper messenger to take the letter, are you? Give it to me and I'll give it to a page."
"I can't, sir. It is my task to deliver it."
The other armiger said, "You needn't be so hard on this young man, Racho. You don't know what he is, do you?" "And you do?" The one called Racho nodded.
"From what part of this citadel are you, messenger?"
"From the Matachin Tower. Master Gerlo sends me to the archivist."
The other armiger's face tightened.
"You are a torturer, then?"
"Only an apprentice, sir."
"I don't wonder, then, that my friend wants you out of his sight.
Follow the gallery to the third door, make your turn and continue about 100 paces, climb the stair to the second landing, and take the corridor south to the double doors at the end."
"Thank you," I said, and took a step in the direction he had indicated.
"Wait a bit. If you go now, we'll have to look at you."
Racho said, "I'd as soon have him ahead of us as behind us."
I waited nonetheless, with one hand resting on the leg of the ladder, for the two of them to turn a corner. Like one of those half-spiritual friends who in dreams addresses us from the clouds, the old man said, "So you're a torturer, are you? Do you know I've never been to your place?" He had a weak glance, reminding me of the turtles we sometimes frightened on the banks of Guile, and a nose and chin that nearly met.
"Grant I never see you there," I said politely.
"Nothing to fear now. What could you do with a man like me? My heart would stop like that." He dropped his sponge into his bucket and attempted to snap his wet fingers, though no sound came. "Know where it is, though. Behind the witch's keep. Isn't that right?"
"Yes," I said, a trifle surprised that the witches were better known than we.
"Thought so. Nobody never talks about it, though. You're angry about those armigers, and I don't blame you. But you ought to know how it is with them. They're supposed to be like exultants, only they're not. They're afraid to die, afraid to hurt, and afraid to act like it. It's hard on them."
"They should be done away with," I said. "Vodalus would set them quarrying. They're only a carryover from some past age. What possible help can they give the world?"
The old man cocked his head. "Why, what help was they to begin? Do you know?" When I admitted I did not, he scrambled down from the ladder like an aged monkey, seeming all arms and legs and wrinkled neck. His hands were as long as my feet, the crooked fingers laced with blue veins. "I'm Rudisund, the curator. You know old Ultan, I take it? No, of course not. If you did, you'd know the way to the library."
I said, "I've never been in this part of the citadel before."
"Never been here?
Why, this is the best part. Art, music, and books.
We've a fetch in here that shows 3 girls dressing another one with flowers that's so real you expect the bees to come out of it. A Quartiosa, too. Not popular anymore, Quartiosa isn't, or we wouldn't have him here.
But the day he was born, he was a better draftsman than the drippers and spitters they're wild for today. We get what the House Absolute don't want, you see? That means we get the old ones, and they're the best, mostly. Come in here dirty from having hung so long, and I cleaned them up. Sometimes I cleaned them again, after they've hung here a time. We've got a fetch in here. It's the truth. Or you take this one now. Like it?
It seemed safe to say I did.
Third time for it. When I was new come, I was old Bronwallader's apprentice, and he taught me how to clean. This was the one he used, because he said it wasn't worth nothing. He begun down here in this corner. When he'd done about as much as you could cover with one hand, he turned it over to me, and I did the rest. Back when my wife still lived, I cleaned it again. That would be after our second girl was born. It wasn't all that dark, but I had things in my mind and wanted something to do. Today, I took the notion to clean it again. And it needs it. See how nice it's brightening up? There's your blue earth coming over his shoulder again, fresh as the autarch's fish.
All this time, the name of Vodalus was echoing in my mind. I felt certain the old man had come down from his ladder only because I had mentioned it, and I wanted to ask him about it. But try as I might, I could find no way to bring the conversation around to it. When I had been silent a moment too long and was afraid he was about to mount his ladder and begin cleaning again, I managed to say, "Is that the moon? I have been told it's more fertile."
"Now it is, yes. This was done before they got it irrigated. See that gray-brown? In those times, that's what you'd see if you looked up at her. Not green like she is now.
Didn't seem so big either, because it wasn't so close in.
That's what old Bronwallader used to say. Now there's trees enough on it to hide Nilimon, as the saw goes."
I seized my opportunity. "Or Vodalus." Rudisund cackled.
"Or him, that's right enough. Your bunch must be rubbing their hands waiting to have him. Got something special planned?"
If the guild had particular excruciations reserved for specific individuals, I knew nothing of it, but I endeavored to look wise and said, "We'll think of something."
"I suppose you will. A bit ago, though, I thought you was for him. Still, you'll have to wait if he's hiding in the forests of Loon."
Rudisund looked up at the picture with obvious appreciation before turning back to me.
"I'm forgetting, you want to visit our master, Ultan. Go back to that arch you just come by."
"I know the way," I said. "The armiger told me."
The old curator blew those directions to the winds with a puff of sour breath. "What he laid down would only get you to the reading room. From there it'd take you a watch to get to Ultan, if ever you did. No, step back to that arch. Go through and all the way to the end of the big room there and down the stair. You'll come to a locked door. Pound till somebody lets you in. That's the bottom of the stacks. And that's where Ultan has his study."
Since Rudisund was watching, I followed his directions, though I had not liked the part about the locked door, and steps downward suggested I might be nearing those ancient tunnels where I had wandered looking for Triskel. On the whole, I felt far less confident than when I was in those parts of the citadel that I knew. I have learned since that strangers who visit it are awed by its size, but it is only a moat in the city spread about it, and we who grew up within the gray curtain wall and have learned the names and relationships of the hundred or so landmarks necessary to those who would find their way in it are by that very knowledge discomfited when we find ourselves away from the familiar regions. So it was with me as I walked through the arch the old man had indicated. Like the rest of that vaulted hall, it was of dull reddish brick, but it was upheld by two pillars
whose capitals bore the faces of sleepers, and I found the silent lips and pale closed eyes more terrible than the agonized masks painted on the metal of our own tower. Each picture in the room beyond contained a book. Sometimes there were many or prominent. Some I had to study for some time before I saw the corner of a binding thrusting from the pocket of a woman's skirt, or realized that some strangely wrought spool held words spun like thread. The steps were narrow and steep and without railings. They twisted as they descended, so that I had not gone down more than 30 before the light of the room above was nearly cut off. At last, I was forced to put my hands before me and feel my way, for fear I would break my head in the door. My questing fingers never encountered it. Instead, the steps ended, and I nearly fell in stepping off a step that was not there, and I was left to grope across an uneven floor in total darkness.
"Who's there?"
a voice called. It was a strangely resonant one, like the sound of a bell tolled inside a cave. Chapter 6 The Master of the Curators.
"Who's there?"
echoed in the dark. As boldly as I could, I said, "Someone with a message."
"Let me hear it, then."
My eyes were growing used to the dark at last, and I could just make out a dim and very lofty shape moving among dark, ragged shapes that were taller still.
"It is a letter, sir," I answered. "Are you Master Ultan, the curator?"
"None other."
He was standing before me now. What I had at first thought was a whitish garment now appeared to be a beard, reaching nearly to his waist. I was as tall already as many men who are called so, but he was a head and a half taller than I, a true exultant.
"Then here you are, sir," I said, and held out the letter.
He did not take it.
"Whose apprentice are you?"
Again I seemed to hear bronze, and quite suddenly I felt that he and I were dead, and that the darkness surrounding us was grave soil, pressing in about our eyes. Grave soil, through which the bell called us to worship at whatever shrines may exist below ground. The livid woman I had seen dragged from her grave rose before me so vividly that I seemed to see her face in the almost luminous whiteness of the figure who spoke.
"Whose apprentice?"
he asked again.
"No one's. That is, I am an apprentice of our guild. Master Gerlow sent me, sir. Master Palaemon teaches us apprentices mostly."
"But not grammar?"
Very slowly the tall man's hand groped toward the letter.
"Oh, yes, grammar too."
I felt like a child talking to this man, who had already been old when I was born. "Master Palaemon says we must be able to read and write and calculate, because when we are masters in our time, we'll have to send letters and receive the instructions of the courts and keep records and accounts."
"Like this,"
the dim figure before me intoned.
"Letters such as this."
"Yes, sir. Just so."
"And what does this say?"
"I don't know. It's sealed, sir."
"If I open it..."
I heard the brittle wax snap under the pressure of his fingers.
"Will you read it to me?"
"It's dark in here, sir," I said doubtfully.
"Then we'll have to have Saibi. Excuse me."
In the gloom, I could barely see him turn away and raise his hands to form a trumpet.
"Saibi! Saibi!"
The name rang through the dark corridors I sensed all about me as the iron tongue struck the echoing bronze on one side, then the other. There was an answering call from far off. For some time we waited in silence. At last I saw light down a narrow alley, bordered, as it seemed, by precipitous walls of uneven stone. It came nearer. A five-branched candlestick, carried by a stocky, very erect man of 40 or so, with a flat, pale face. The bearded man beside me said,
"There you are at last, Sibe. Have you brought a light?"
"Yes, master." "Who is this?"
"A messenger with a letter."
In a more ceremonious tone, Master Oldtown said to me,
"This is my own apprentice, Sibe. We have a guild, too. We curators, of whom the librarians are a division. I am the only master librarian here, and it is our custom to assign our apprentices to our senior members. Sibe has been mine for some years now."
I told Sibe that I was honored to meet him and asked, somewhat timidly, what the feast day of the curators was, a question that must have been suggested by the thought that a great many of them must have gone by without Sibe's being elevated to journeymen.
"It is now past," Master Oldtown said.
He looked toward me as he spoke, and in the candlelight I could see that his eyes were the color of watered milk.
"In early spring, it is a beautiful day. The trees put out their new leaves then, in most years."
There were no trees in the grand court, but I nodded. Then, realizing he could not see me, I said,
"Yes, beautiful, with soft breezes."
"Precisely. You are a young man after my own heart."
He put his hand on my shoulder. I could not help noticing that his fingers were dark with dust.
"Sibe, too, is a young man after my heart. He will be chief librarian here when I am gone. We have a procession, you know, we curators, down Eubaw Street. He walks beside me then, the two of us robed in gray. What is the tinct of your own guild?"
"Fuligin," I told him. "The color that is darker than black."
"There are trees, sycamores and oaks, rock maples and duckfoot trees, said to be the oldest on earth. The trees spread their shade on either side of Eubaw Street, and there are more on the esplanades down the center. Shopkeepers come to their doors to see the quaint curators, you know, and of course the booksellers and antique dealers cheer us. I suppose we are one of the spring sights of Nessus, in our little way."
"It must be very impressive," I said.
"It is, it is. The cathedral is very fine, too, once we reach it. There are banks of tapers, as though the sun were shining on the night sea, and candles in blue glass to symbolize the claw. Enfolded in light, we conduct our ceremonies before the high altar. Tell me, does your own guild go to the cathedral?"
I explained that we used the chapel here in the citadel, and expressed surprise that the librarians and other curators left its walls.
"We are entitled to, you see. The library itself does, doesn't it, Sibe?"
"Indeed it does, master."
Sibe had a high square forehead, from which his graying hair was in retreat. It made his face seem small and a trifle babyish. I could understand how Ultan, who must occasionally have run his fingers over it as Master Palaemon sometimes ran his over mine, could think him still almost a boy.
"You are in close contact, then, with your opposite numbers in the city?" I said.
The old man stroked his beard.
"The closest, for we are they. This library is the city library, and the library of the House Absolute, too, for that matter, and many others."
"Do you mean that the rabble of the city is permitted to enter the citadel to use your library?"
"No,"
said Ultan.
"I mean that the library itself extends beyond the walls of the citadel. Nor, I think, is it the only institution here that does so. It is thus that the contents of our fortress are so much larger than their containers.